Greetings and welcome to the AVOD. I'm Count Vargelon.
I'm DM.
And man oh man, do we have a show for you tonight. It's not the show we planned it to be, but we think it's pretty good anyway. You're going to be pleasantly surprised.
It's almost the show we planned.
It's 2/3 of the show we planned it to be, and you'd think adding a third movie in there would bring that up to a full third, extra third. But no, the movie we added in there does not qualify as a third. But hey, we'll get there in like 7 minutes. So for right now, let's just get some random crap going.
Yeah, so last week we had a really good time with the movie Hell Night. In particular, the term or phrase gorked out.
Yep.
Which we'd never heard before and didn't know what it meant. I looked it up.
Ooh.
And it's a real phrase.
Okay.
And it means someone who's heavily medicated.
But that's not
over medicated to the point where they're like
incapacitated. Like Michael Myers was supposed to be at the beginning of Halloween. So whacked out on Thorazine, he wouldn't even be able to keep his head up.
Yeah, that would be gorked out.
So that's what gorked out means.
Yeah.
That couldn't be a worse description of Andrew.
The gorked out son. I know, because that guy isn't heavily medicated. He's not
medicated at all.
Catatonic.
Yeah. I feel like they were massively misusing that term.
So anyway.
But I'm glad to now know what gorked out is supposed to mean, even if it didn't wind up meaning that in the movie we watched. we have more random crap though. First off, I'd just like to say that Grand Theft Auto 5 is coming out, and it was a weird surprise announcement. Like, they essentially, everyone knew they were working on it, right? But they made no announcements at all. And then just last week they just popped out, "Oh, here's a trailer, we're almost done."
Oh.
It is quite impressive. And so there's one thing I found out based on the trailer, and that is it seems to star Robert De Niro. Or at least he's briefly in it. But anyway, there's a guy, we don't hear any voices except for like the main character, but there's a guy in there who looks suspiciously like Robert De Niro. And casting, like making people look like the voice actor would be a first for them. But then again, if you're paying for De Niro, you want every penny of that on screen, I guess. So that's interesting. But the thing we didn't learn that I'm very excited to learn is, will William Fichtner once again be reprising his role as Sean Penn's character from the movie Carlito's Way?
Wow, that made like no sense.
I know. You really have to have played all of the Grand Theft Auto games and seen Carlito's Way for that to make sense. But the point is, he was a fast-talking Jewish lawyer in Carlito's Way, Sean Penn. And then when they made Vice City, that was the one with Ray Liotta. They're like, "Oh, we should have that exact character in this video game." And it was played by William Fichtner. And everybody liked him so much, he was back in San Andreas in a minor capacity. And I'm pretty sure he survived that game too. So I'm kind of hoping he'll be back again, since this new one is also set in San Andreas.
So, I learned something interesting about Grand Theft Auto.
I like it when people tell me interesting things about Grand Theft Auto.
I don't know which game it is, but in one of the games, there is music there by a guy who's on the Drive soundtrack.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, well, if it's the 80s style Tangerine Dream music, that might be Vice City.
That's the one.
Yeah, they had a lot of that in Vice City. Same guy, huh?
Yeah, Kavinsky, I believe, is his name.
Well, that's fantastic, because he's just very skilled at that genre of music. And I know it's not strictly speaking horror, but it's such a nerd thing that I thought, yeah, I wanted to give it a shout out and say, I, too, am looking forward to Grand Theft Auto 5. Surprising no one.
And another non-horror item you want to talk about.
Well, the thing is, it's kind of borderline.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why. I want to talk about The Mentalist and how I think The Mentalist might secretly be one of the most edgy shows on television.
how is that even possible?
It doesn't sound like it is possible, but the fact is, one of the main themes, the continuing B plot of the show is that the main character, the mentalist, wants to kill the serial killer who murdered his family. And I want to stress this. He does not want to capture the guy or put him in jail. He's just like, no, I'm going to kill that guy. And he's very open about this fact, and to the point that at the end of last season, he killed a guy because he thought it was him.
Okay.
The guy said things that convinced Patrick, the mentalist, that he was the killer, so Patrick shot him to death. And that was the season ender. And he's the main character of a CBS procedural doing that kind of stuff. It seems weirdly daring to be on primetime, you know, network television to have a character. And this past week, he tricked someone into getting murdered. Like, there was a killer he wasn't going to be able to catch, so he tricked him into getting himself murdered.
Wow.
And I'm like, this is a network TV show. This is not what I'm expecting. And the thing is, it's all very well, like, Simon Baker puts in a great performance every week. He's very entertaining. But more importantly than that, like, the character is just openly pro-vigilantism, and the show doesn't really seem to judge him for that.
See, I have a problem with Tunney? Is that the woman?
Robin Tunney,
yeah.
Okay.
Like, it's my issue, I know that. I have a problem with her, and I can't watch the show.
Okay, I guess that.
I like kind of Simon Baker. I can't deal with.
You just hate Robin Tunney so much.
Robin Tunney.
Well, what's really fascinating about the show is, now the serial killer they're always chasing, he calls himself Red John. He loves murder, but beyond that, he seems to have a cult of people who work for him. Right? And the strange thing is, back in season two, they started opening up this cult idea, right? And this is the reason I really wanted to mention on the show. But they didn't really have a sense of what that cult meant or how it would come together. But he seemed to be a guy, a serial killer, who, like, gave tips to and helped out other people who were serial killers or wanted to be. Which is pretty nuts.
That's suspiciously like an idea you once told me.
Yeah, I know.
Hashtag right? Zero.
Yeah, it is. Not my idea. Different thing. But anyway, the point is.
Yeah.
So this is, they hadn't fully fleshed out what it was. And what fascinates me so much is clearly between season two and three, you know, they saw Sherlock.
Right.
And they're like, oh my God, we didn't realize it, but he's a consulting criminal. like we didn't realize, we didn't have the word for what we created,
right?
But now, because we saw Sherlock, we do have a word for what we created and a framework. So now that's more, as of this past season, that's more clearly what he's doing.
Okay.
Like, he's helping out other people, who he's finding other criminals and giving them help and advice, and has a network of criminals who will do his bidding. Also, and this is just what I love about the show. The show is about a guy who's a hypnotist and, manipulator. And the villain is, in fact, the world's greatest hypnotist.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so our hero is a pretty good hypnotist, but the villain is a much, much better hypnotist.
Oh, so it'll be interesting when they finally square off.
Oh, I know. And, they've also, weirdly, they kind of, if you were paying attention, revealed who the killer was. Like, it's one of these big mysteries, but they kind of revealed who it was in the second season ender, because the guy who they put in the suit and everything had a super recognizable voice.
Right.
But I don't know how apparent they mean that to be for the audience, and that actor hasn't been on the show again since. So I'm like, was that just them using him as a placeholder, or did they really mean that that character is the killer?
I don't know. You might be overthinking that.
I might be overthinking it. You know what? If you watched the show, you would understand what I'm talking about. The point is, I love The Mentalist, and the thing is, it's so much better than you would think just a CBS. Like, don't get me wrong, I like NCIS, but for a CBS procedural, you know what you're getting, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas The Mentalist, it's like, another degree above what CBS is doing in every other show.
Okay.
Like, it's a little darker, it's a little more interesting, it's a little smarter, and it all comes together to be, I just think, a really good show. A really good show that does not get the credit it deserves. Like, you don't see Simon Baker hosting Saturday Night Live, you know, it's just not famous.
Is that even really a good...
It's not a thing anymore. It used to be a thing that you were popular. Out of the 90s, like, now it's just who has a movie opening or, you know... Actually, that is just it. I was about to come up with something else. Or who is running for president? Because like, it used to be if you had a really popular TV show, they would put you on, you know, Saturday Night Live. That's why all of the Friends, except for Joey...
I was alive in the 90s. Do know that.
Our viewer might not have been, but the point is, that's why every Friend except for Joey hosted Saturday Night Live. Or was it except for David Schwimmer? One of them never hosted. But only...
I don't know.
Which, you know, take that, Friend. But anyway, so yeah, I'm just saying, I wholeheartedly recommend The Mentalist if you can stomach to look at the horrible face of Robin Tunney.
Wow, I didn't go that far.
No, I just wanted to make it sound like you were being super mean. Robin Tunney. Like, I have no strong feelings about
where it's coming from, so it's okay.
Yeah, it's weird. I have no strong feelings about her one way or the other. I think she's one of those interchangeable 90s girls.
Right.
You know? But, all right. I think we're ready to move on.
Yes, let's talk about an actual horror television show.
Say borderline, but continue.
Episode 2 of American Horror Story.
Yes! American Horror Story.
So we were lukewarm.
Yeah.
About our feelings on the first episode of American Horror Story, and I was chatting with a friend of mine, and he's desperate to know my opinions on the television show because he's watching it too. And I said, well, you know, I'm watching it on Canadian television, so we're a few episodes behind. And I'm about to watch the second episode. And so I asked him, I'm like, does it get any better or worse? He's like, oh, it calms down somewhat. I'm like, do you mean it comes to a grinding halt? And he didn't really answer me one way or the other. And he was right that the show has calmed down.
Yeah, there weren't 18 plots in the second episode.
I'm still not sure if I like where it's going. Or if I'm even sure where it's going.
I know, right?
And if it sort of keeps up this, here's what happened in the past, and how that affects what's going on in the present, that might be interesting. It might get tired after 13 episodes, because it's a 13-episode season.
And there's going to be a second season.
But still, it's, you know... Because the first episode opened up all of these different plots, now are we going to spend the rest of the season playing catch up, trying to close these off? I don't. Yeah.
Well, it kind of feels like it because there's just so much to explain at this point.
Yeah.
And I feel like they're not going to get us out of that first season without explaining what's going on with Jessica Lange and why the crazy the guy who's stalking his daughter. Is in on the house's evil.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's so much there, so much to explain that I gotta ask, you know, like, can they possibly address all of it, or are they just gonna keep layering other things on top?
It seems,
and by the way, how many murders do there have to be in a house before you just tear that house down?
I know, I can't, because if we're in the double digits.
Which we are.
Yeah, you would think, okay, granted, it's probably a heritage property, and you can't tear those down. But before that house was designated as such, even if they had such a thing in California, I don't know.
Yeah.
I would be surprised to learn if California had any heritage at all.
Ouch!
I'm surprised that house didn't get torn down ages ago, or set on fire. In fact, it was once, and it was good. But
Yeah, so, it did not seem plausible to me that there can have been as many murders as there apparently were in that house.
I was explaining a show to my mom.
Yeah.
Because my mom likes, you know, weird television sort of horror stuff. Like, we'd watched X-Files together and Twin Peaks and that stuff. And so she's like, well, is it any good? I'm like, well, I don't, it's bloated. I think that was one word I used to describe the show. I'm like, really? If your house is that haunted, fucking move.
Which, to be fair, was threatened at the end of episode 2,
yes.
Although that's obviously not going to happen.
Obviously not.
I know, which, by the way, emptiest threat ever.
Ever, I know!
We're moving! You're moving away from the premise of the show? Pretty sure that's not true. But yeah, that was, that really, I thought that was kind of odd. And I am interested to see, like, where this goes. Because I gotta say, you know, I want to know what's going on with Jessica Lange and her evil daughter, who now is slightly less evil.
No, I think Jessica Lange is the evil one. The daughter is just...
She does tend to, like, in addition to all of her attacking, she does seem to want to warn people about the fact that they're going to get murdered if they stop.
Yeah, no, I think Jessica Lange is definitely
the evil,
the evil in that plot.
Yeah.
Yes, and then you have the evil of the stalker would-be boyfriend.
Yeah. And then,
the
of course,
evil of the dead housekeeper, and the evil of the gimp, the evil of the hideously burned guy.
It's just so much going on.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that. So, I mean, I'm interested to see what happened next. The only thing that I put in there that kind of bothered me a little was, and I mean, this is because I'm a serial killer nerd, I guess, was that the killer this week in the flashback, who the villains were trying to recreate the murder of, you know, was a nod to that real guy who killed all those nurses.
And not Ted Bundy?
No, not Ted Bundy. No, no, different guy. This guy...
Oh, a different guy.
Yeah, he broke into a dorm where nurses, students were staying, and he killed 6 women. It was just awful.
Right, because Ted Bundy broke into a sorority house.
That also happened, but this was not a Ted Bundy thing. It was just the...
I read Stranger Beside Me a few months ago.
Oh, okay.
That's why I keep bringing it up.
I was wondering. No, the thing that bothered me was the ridiculous idea that you have to assign a motive for someone to, you know... He specifically hated nurses because blank happened. And I'm like, no, he's just a murderer. You know? These guys just want to kill. They don't have specific motives for the kind of person they're killing. You're trying to make too much sense in a show that really, you know, that's not what this show is about.
Clearly. Well, I made that very clear last week.
I know, right?
The show isn't about making sense. It's just about being as weird and
as
horror-y
it possibly
possible.
Can. Oh, my God. Which, by the way, I think the credits, the opening credits, if you want to know where the show is coming from, it's like, here is every horror image we could possibly slap together.
With some discordant atonal music.
Well,
I mean,
I think the term is noise. Babies in jars, burned corpses. Really? You've heard of horror, but I don't think you've actually seen a horror thing. All right, so obviously we're gonna keep watching it. We're having so much fun. But yeah.
Yes, I did like it better this week.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, I could only go up from where I was last week.
I know. So yeah, I had a better time this week too, and I'm interested to see where it's going. Although, I gotta say, I found the timeline was all weird, because it was clearly, like, I don't know when the show is taking place, because it was winter when they left the East. When she found out about the affair and they left the East. But was that... I always assumed that was like a while ago. Because... I mean, I know it's LA, so they don't have seasons. But at the same time, like, I didn't get the sense that it was still winter. Yet apparently he and his, you know, student girlfriend were together together very recently. So I thought there was more of a time lapse between the little flashback to the opening than there actually was. But that's just, you know, a title card would have helped me a little there. And this is a show that is not afraid of title cards, so I don't know why they didn't give me one.
No, I think it's only been...
like a couple of weeks?
A few weeks, or up to, I guess, a month, maybe a month and a half since they moved.
Yeah, and the thing is, I guess because of his freaking out about how she hadn't forgiven him yet in the first episode...
I know, it made me think like more time had passed.
It seemed like more than 4 weeks since she caught you having sex with one of your students had passed.
Right, unless that student isn't too observant of her own body.
But even still, you know, like, that would be a little strange.
Yeah.
It felt, honestly, I was guessing 6 months had passed. And that's why he was at wit's end.
Yeah, me too. But then you find out that the mistress is pregnant. And it's like, well, either you're a case for that TV show, I Didn't Know I Was Pregnant. Which,
well,
by the
no.
way, lots of fun to watch.
Well, no, she's going to get an abortion, so she's not
clearly
a case for that.
She's only just a little pregnant.
I know. Oh, my God. But anyway, so I get maybe they'll fill us in more next week, or maybe he continued having an affair with the student. I don't know. But the point is, I'm enjoying it. I'm looking forward to see where it's going, and it may be crazy and bizarre and over the top, but we're going to be there, so look out for that. Oh, and did we have anything else? Or was that it for Random Crap? No, that's
it. That was it for Random Crap.
Okay. So let's move on to our first move of the evening, which, amazingly, I'm going to be synopsizing.
I know.
So unusual, right? Although technically it will not be a synopsis. I am just going to read one of my movie haikus. So, pardon me. Asylum, a poem by Count Vargelon. I was just scrolling to the page it was on. The least essential Nightmare on Elm Street happens. This pleases no one.
Oh, that's perfect.
Isn't that the exact plot of the movie?
Yes.
Like the least essential Nightmare on Elm Street imaginable. So you want to tell the story of how we wound up watching this?
Okay, so this week's theme, because we were going to have a theme this week, and we still kind of do.
Yeah.
Is found footage ghost hunting movie.
Yes.
And we wanted to watch one of the movies that we selected for this week is Paranormal Activity 2 Tokyo Night, which we'll discuss in just a moment. I encountered some major technical difficulties with specific to PA2 Tokyo Night and wasn't able to watch it. So I found a Haunted Asylum movie, because the other two films we're discussing this evening are about Haunted Asylum. But the movie Asylum isn't a found footage film. It's just a straight up narrative horror movie. And it sort of fits in with the theme of Haunted Asylum, but it doesn't fit in at all with their theme of found footage. And we probably would have been better off not watching it at all. Because so bad really isn't the right word to describe it. One note might be a good word.
One note is good. It is a film without depth or subtext. it is a film where things don't make a lot of sense. A woman who saw her father shoot himself in the head, a suicide that, you know, was motivated by him thinking that things were out to get him, and you assume is going to be important later, but isn't. A woman who had that happen to her when she was a child, and then had her brother also shoot himself in the head when he went nuts going to a university, then elects to go to that same university in one of the most baffling character choices I've ever seen. And that the film, baffling enough that the film feels the need to try to address why she did it at some point, but the film cannot come up with a reason that makes any sense whatsoever. So after you hear it, you're just kind of like, I wish they had just ignored the question.
Well, I don't even understand why, like, this suggestion that her family is
had a history of mental illness.
Health issues. It's like, that's not okay. She's at this university, and her dorm is a converted asylum. Yes, but that's got nothing to do. Her backstory has got nothing to do with the plot.
Rest of the characters there do not have a history of mental illness, and they're just as easily victimized by Freddy as she is.
Right.
Dr. Burke?
Burke, yes. I was going to say Baker.
Yeah, I think it's Dr. Burke. But anyway, so yeah, they're just as viable victims as she is. So that didn't really make any sense at all. And by the way, in an amazing coincidence, every single character who shares the dorm with her has an easy to quantify mental problem that can be exploited by Freddy.
Right. Well, they all have their own tragic backstories that Dr. Burke,
magically knows about.
And exploit this set. So everything you expect is going to happen does. One note was the term I used to describe, because basically just Dr. Burke, he goes from one person to the next in the cast, killing them in ways that reference their tragic past.
Yeah.
And you're just waiting for him to work his way up to the final girl.
Yeah. And some of their tragic past, I'm not trying to make fun of people with serious mental problems, but a couple of them are pretty ridiculous. And one of them is...
Well, these aren't even mental problems. That's not even
I know, you're right. It's not even mental problems. It's just a bad thing that happened to them.
It's just baggage.
Exactly. Well, and one of them is dealing with her abusive boyfriend, right? And again, this is her first year in university, right? And
how old are these people?
They're all supposed to be 18, but this woman's abusive ex-boyfriend is clearly 45. Like, and I feel like she had to have something going on at home in addition to her abusive boyfriend that she was dating a 45-year-old.
Living with him, even.
Living with him, even. Like, what is going on here? And it's the same way. I don't understand why the a-hole from Friday the 13th, right? He seemed to have actually gotten a hold of and conquered his mental problems.
It's not a mental problem.
Oh, sorry, his baggage. He seems like he had kind of dealt with his baggage. Yeah, he's not talking to his horrible, abusive mother anymore, but he's fit. He seems relatively happy. He doesn't have an eating disorder anymore. Like, how can this doctor... And you realize the doctor isn't really exploiting a problem you have. It's just anything in your life that he can exploit... that theoretically could be used to, you know, murder you, he can just do whether or not you feel bad about it.
Yeah.
And then you have the worst one, which is a character whose tragic backstory is literally that he was part of an anti-drug PSA from the 1990s. And it sounds like I'm kidding, but in the 90s there was actually an anti-drug PSA about a kid who was supposed to be looking out for his little brother. But instead he smoked pot and his little brother drowned in a pool. And so that is this guy's backstory. And I don't know if they were jokingly referencing that or if they independently came to the same conclusion as the people doing that PSA did.
I don't know.
But
or if it's a reference, I don't think it's supposed to be a joke.
Okay, well, there you go.
The movie doesn't have...
No, this has no sense of humor. And I guess before we move on, because I guess there's not a lot more to say about this movie.
I could point out some inconsistencies in the story if you
oh,
like.
Please do. But before you get to that, I just wanted to say, least plausible dorm ever.
Well, this is what I... So, she goes to, like, I don't know, David Miller University. I don't know what it's called.
Doesn't...
And, yes, she's in a new dorm, opened this year, which is an old asylum building, half of which hasn't been converted yet. It's closed off, it's derelict, but her per section of the building, her half of the building, is actually quite nice, and they did a very good job renovating it. However, they're supposed to be the first group of students to live in this dorm. But it would appear that this building has been open for some time and people lived in it last year.
Yeah.
And in years previous. That doesn't make any sense. It's supposed to be a brand new building.
Not only that, but here's something that I didn't find plausible at all. So
it's the most boring frosh week on the planet.
Well, yeah. And let's not forget that there's like...
In the common room.
Well,
and they all have single rooms. I'm sorry.
They all, not only do they have single rooms, but despite this being a huge dorm, no one else lives in it.
Well, no, there's like the six of them. There's the RA, and there's some people on some other floors.
Yes, but the point is, that is a huge floor. There should not only be six people on the entire floor.
Well, if they all have single rooms.
Even still. No,
I know.
What I found the funniest, right, was the look. The idea that a university would go to the effort of massively, beautifully renovating this one half of the decrepit asylum and then leave the other half to be like decrepit, crumbling stone and boards awkwardly hammered over windows. Like, even if you weren't going to do the repairs yet, it's called scaffolding. You put up scaffolding, you drape some green, no one knows a monstrously ugly horror building is there.
Also, maybe don't tell the curious freshman. This is the only door into the haunted asylum.
You're not allowed to go there. I repeat, this door is a forbidden fruit that you are not allowed to sample. Apparently, the RA has never met a teenager.
It'd be a great setup for a joke in a horror movie.
I know.
But
as you said,
a moment ago, this movie doesn't have a sense of humor.
So. Oh, not even a little. And then one of my favorite things is the way it kind of just completely falls apart right at the end because they are trying to escape from the asylum.
What the hell did they run to?
And they run through a relatively short tunnel, and we find out that this college campus, which was built next to an asylum in the first place, right, is also next to a decrepit, like, industrial park and railroad.
Yes!
What?
Out in the middle of the country.
Out in the middle of nowhere! Yeah, so, no, that didn't make the most sense.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, this movie had a lot of problems. And to the point where, like, I noticed the thing, you know, thanks to this film was made possible by participation of the South Carolina film credit or whatever. And I'm like, was this entirely made because you could get tax credits from Carolina? Because I'm not against making a movie for that reason, but work a little harder on the script, guys.
Well, I guess they had access to this wonderful building and a fantastic tax incentive.
So they're like, screw it, let's just make a movie. We'll figure it out when we get there. And, hey!
You're wrong.
We've got the stars of both Friday the 13th, the remake, and terrible movie Chain Letter. So, how can this go wrong? I know that this movie was made before either of those things happened, but I just wanted to point out that I recognized both of those guys.
Good for you. Good job.
Okay, I'm not really proud of that, but still. Chain Letter. All right, so I think we're ready to put Asylum to bed.
Yes.
And move on to the movies we're actually here to talk about. So, yeah. I guess I should briefly fill you in on what happened in Tokyo Nights. I think I'm going to want you to watch this at some point in the distant future. But just for now, I want to say that I actually liked a good bit of super low budget Paranormal Activity Tokyo Nights, the, you know, non-official ripoff of Paranormal Activity. There were problems, but, you know, the structure of it worked well. It escalated nicely. They had very low key, you know, ghost gags that were effectively creepy in a lot of places. It got sloppy in a bunch of different places, and it's not fantastic, but it did have a way better setup for a sequel to Paranormal Activity than Paranormal Activity 2 did.
Okay.
And now I'm going to tell you what the setup is, because you're going to be so happy. All right. So Paranormal Activity 2, it's a prequel. It explains where the demon came from. And it's not very convincing, but who cares? This one. So remember how Katie killed Mr. Micah at the end of the first movie? I call him that because Japanese people don't understand the way we use names. So when a guy looks at a newspaper article about it, he sees that the name of the man murdered was Mr. Micah.
Okay.
But anyway, so after she killed Mr. Micah, she, you know, disappeared and no one had seen her. Well, according to the film Paranormal Activity 2, Tokyo Night, what happened was she ran out into the street and got hit by a car.
Hmm.
And that car was being driven by the woman at the center of this movie. And running over a demon-possessed woman sadly transfers the possession to you.
Oh, that's creative.
It's nice, right? Like, that's just a good premise. And I was very entertained. And that's explaining how the curse got to Japan. And then, I mean, if I'm being brutally honest, then the movie Paranormal Activity happens. But you know what? That was the real Paranormal Activity 2 as well. So, you know, it's not like they were a lot less creative. In fact, in many ways, they were more creative than Paranormal Activity. They had a bunch of good, you know, in-camera ghost gags. A couple of them were generally unexpected. And they pulled the old thing that I've seen a couple of times in movies where people, you know, confront a demon spirit with a cross, and then they find the cross gets tossed away and set on fire. And I'm like, see, that wouldn't discourage me from using the cross. That would say to me, I need a bigger cross, or I need a lot of crosses, because
right.
Obviously, you know, the demon did not mind your attempt at a Shinto banishment, but it freaked out when you used that cross on it. So
yeah.
Get a little more into the crosses, guys. Try that out. But anyway, so yeah, I'm not completely recommending the movie, but I enjoyed it more than I enjoyed Paranormal Activity 2. So that's worth something, isn't it?
Yes. Because Paranormal 2, too, I thought was kind of flat, maybe.
It really was.
Yeah, and it was, yeah, like kind of a rehash of the first movie. So is this a bit more its own film, Tokyo Night?
I think it is. I think it is a bit more of its own film, because it's even got a great reveal.
Okay.
It's even got I'm not going to ruin the reveal, because I do want people to check out this movie if they're able. So, yeah, I mean, it is a, I assume, unauthorized ripoff of Paranormal Activity, where copyright law, the lack of good international copyright law, has allowed this movie to be made. But in this case, you know, unlike all, like, Indian Nightmare on Elm Street, it's really a good job.
Okay.
So let's get to the movies we both saw.
Okay, so next on the list. Our ghost hunting found footage movie is Grave Encounters, which is new this year. We're on top of things for once.
Woo!
Okay. Grave Encounters is a ghost hunting television show. And for the show's sixth episode, the crew spends the night locked inside Collingwood Psychiatric Hospital. The film chronicles the crew's time inside the building as they look for and eventually encounter the supernatural.
Okay, I have a question.
All right, I have an answer.
How much of this movie are we going to spoil?
Well, I think we're going to have to spoil quite a bit of it. So if you haven't seen Grave Encounters...
And you like found footage Blair Witchy movies... I think you owe it to yourself, yeah, to check this out and just skip ahead until we talk about episode 50, which we don't care if you see.
And we don't care if we ruin it for you either.
No, we really don't. But yeah, like if you would all want to see a really competently done Blair Witchy kind of movie, absolutely skip the rest of this review because there's a bunch of stuff in the movie that I think you're going to enjoy. So check it out on your own. And then come back and obviously listen to us talk about it. You know, because that way we get two listens.
Which is 1.5 more than we usually get.
All right. So now let's spoil the movie. There's a reason I keep using the term Blair Witch. And that is because this film is essentially the same movie as The Blair Witch Project, but just way better made.
Well, it is and it isn't. Like, these guys really kind of went all out.
They did. And I think
what to do in terms of ghost effects.
Well, and I think the greatest surprise in the movie, and this isn't a moment, like the greatest surprise I had in the movie, and this is what I love about going to movies without knowing anything, is that this film has a way bigger budget than you think it does when you start watching.
Yeah.
And, like, the beginning of the movie looks so cheap, you were totally unprepared for the caliber of effects that they can bring to bear. In the second half of the movie. I mean, like a movie like Cloverfield, you know from the opening seconds that they had a lot of money to spend. Right? It's, oh, look, it's recognizable actors. Oh, look, they're actually filming in Manhattan and blah, 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 blah. Right? So, like, these people clearly had a lot of money to spend, so it's not surprising when they can afford, you know, giant bugs running around the sewers of New York. Whereas this movie, like, I have seen so many of these crap fake footage movies, and the opening just looks just like it. I was totally unprepared for the both caliber and quantity of ghost effects they were going to toss at me.
Well, I had, like, the first actual, like, ghost effect or ghost encounter, I had ruined for me.
Oh, no.
In the trailer.
Damn.
I know, and I hate that. Oh my god.
Kill that.
I know, I feel a rant coming on. Not here. No.
God damn it, trailers. Why would you kill? Because that's the greatest asset this film has going for it.
I know, and they go back to that well a couple of times, but then they do some other creative stuff with their ghosts.
Yeah.
One thing, though, that I really liked, and this isn't the ghost effect, this has nothing to do with the ghost, but really more about the asylum itself.
Yeah.
At one point in the movie, and this is a turning point, they try to leave, and they break open the doors, and what they thought was the door to the outside.
I know.
Is no longer a door to the outside.
Oh, how
and
great was
actually,
that?
Actually, they are trapped inside the asylum. The building rearranges itself to keep these people inside. And I thought that was brilliant.
Oh, yeah, no, it was great. Again, just like the Blair Witch Project. And I mean, I don't want to lean on this too much, but it's the same movie. It's just because I've been pissed off at the Blair Witch Project and people's love for it for so long that when I see someone saying, look, we're going to remake the Blair Witch Project, but better, and actually pull it off, I want to give them, I don't want to, like, accuse them of being ripoff artists. I want to give them credit for doing it right, you know?
See, I really liked Blair Witch, so.
But you got to admit, I think this was better.
I don't know, actually.
Oh, I think this is more fun.
It's different. I mean, it's the same idea,
oh,
obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all coming, they're all drawn from the same well. That's the second time I use that, I have to stop.
There's an effect, and the one thing that bugged me when I saw the kind of budget they did have for effects is there's one effect they couldn't afford to do, and it really bothered me. Mm-hmm. And that's when, like, a guy walks up to a bathtub full of blood, right?
Yeah.
And you know there's someone in the bathtub full of blood who's going to jump out and get him. I've seen a movie. And then I'm sitting there thinking, oh my god, and all I can think is what's going to happen is he's going to get dragged into the bathtub full of blood, and then they're going to knock it over, and he's not going to be there.
Right.
And that is what happens, but they can't afford to actually do that effect.
Yeah.
because that is a pricier effect than just putting in monsters and things like that that they normally do and distorting faces. And so the one time that the effects did not live up to their ambitions, I guess it bothered me because the effects work so well in the rest of the movie.
Right. Well, I guess they just couldn't, as you said, couldn't afford it. So.
Yeah. So I almost wish, like, I wish that they had lowered their expectations or their ambitions for that one shot, so I wouldn't have seen the budget fail them the way I did. Is that strange? That's strange, isn't it? Yeah.
Maybe a little strange.
Okay, can we talk about mockumentaries versus found footage films?
Yes.
Okay, good, because this film essentially posits itself, and I was trying to think, what is the difference between a mockumentary and a found footage film? And I think it really comes down to perceived authorial intent.
I think it's the presentation.
Okay, that's what in a fake documentary, right? And what I'm saying is found footage can actually be a fake documentary because in that case, it's the editor who is the author of the film. Right. And when there's a clear, when I'm just seeing stuff that happened to people and I feel like I'm seeing all the footage, weirdly, like Paranormal Activity, you kind of feel like this is all the footage he shot. I'm watching it in order. This is found footage. The same way with the Blair Witch Project, you know, you feel like this is all the footage they shot or all the footage that was covered. I'm watching it in chronological order. This is found footage. The second you start having a clear message being put across by the editor, I feel like you've crossed over from found footage into fake documentary, and I feel like this is more fake documentary than found footage.
Well, this is, yeah.
And I'll tell you why. Okay. In the lead up to, if this film actually was 76 hours of raw footage, edited down into, you know, 90 minutes or an hour and 100 minutes, right? There would not be so much footage of how fake ghost shows are set up. Like, there is an extended sequence at the beginning that just lays out over and over again how artificial and how fake everything you see on a paranormal investigator show is.
Yeah.
Right. If this is a thing that actually happened, you would not go because they're trying to make the, you know, really obvious point. Oh, well, look at how fake it is. And boom, then something real happened. But the thing is, we know it's fake and we know we're watching a movie. Like if this were actually something that happened, I feel like there was more ghost footage that you could have gotten into that 5 minutes. We didn't need to see him, like, starting to do the introduction of the building and then having a car interrupt his introduction and them having to start it again. Like, that's,
yeah.
You're just wasting time showing me that when you could be showing me real live ghosts that you actually saw.
Well, the thing is, though, with the, I guess, I mean, I outline this, I talk about this briefly on my blog because I did write quite a long piece about grave encounters. And I make the distinction between found footage and documentary.
No.
And documentaries, or fake documentaries, I should say, mockumentaries, have a finished quality about them.
Yeah.
And they've been produced and edited and put together in a certain way. Found footage movies are just, here's what we found, and we're throwing it up on the screen. And there's a minimal amount of involvement in the editing or the producing of the finished product.
Yeah.
Grave Encounters, I guess it's somewhere in between because the film does have its problems, and this is where most of them come into play, is actually in the opening of the film.
Oh, I was just about to get to Guy. I want to...
And in the editing. The movie opens with an introduction by the television show's producer, who sort of sets it up as, you know, for the 50th episode, Grave Encounters went to the asylum.
Sixth episode, 50th episode
Sorry,
is episode 50.
For the sixth episode, they went to the asylum to spend the weekend, and they were never heard from again. And then eventually, I guess, they found the 74 hours of tape.
Not that that's in any way explained.
They've edited... no, they've edited that down to, you know, this, I guess, 90-minute presentation or whatever it is. I don't know what the runtime is. And one of the problems, as you said, is that there's no, that sets up a bookend.
Yeah.
But there's no, you don't get the other half of that. The end of the movie.
That so pissed me off.
Producer doesn't come back to kind of read you out. And that's a failing. That's a problem in the script.
Yeah, it really is.
Because of the way it's set up. And yeah. So that presents this as a mockumentary. Because you've got the introduction by the producer.
Well, as I was saying about authorial intent, we meet the author of the movie.
But then, and you have all of this behind the scenes stuff in the setup of the television program.
Yeah.
And that's all, you know, it's raw and that, and you have to question why they would include something like that.
Which is what I was doing.
I talk about this in my review. I think that has more to do with issues of reality and make-believe inherent in reality television programming that exists outside of this film. And so that puts Grave Encounters in sort of this weird gray area where it's both. It's found footage. The majority of the film is just found footage, and it's all in chronological order of the events that happen in the movie.
Yeah.
They have been edited down and rearranged to tell a story. But you have all of this.
Well, you have all this nonsense about how, you know, reality TV shows are produced, but the thing is, that's not what this movie is about.
Well, I'm going to encourage you to read what I wrote, because okay. I make a case that this movie is partly about that, because it addresses issues of what's real and what's fake. And the Grave Encounter television show is a reality television show, but it's all faked.
Yeah.
All the time. And then they encounter the supernatural for real. And then their own reality becomes deconstructed and reconstructed by the supernatural and the paranormal phenomenon that takes place inside of the asylum. So it's quite layered.
And I'm sure that's going to be an interesting article for everyone to read. But instead of having you recap it here, I just want to say that the thing that really bugged me about the movie is if they – well, no, we know what really bugged me, the lack of, as you say, a readout. But the other thing that really bugged me is there's all of this, you know, fussing and mishigas about them being locked in, right? And having to wait for the guy to let them out. But the fact is, if every single part of this show is fake, and the fact that the door is locked doesn't really matter because the place has changed shape, I don't know why the guy had them really be locked in. Like, every single part of this show is fake, but he really had the guys lock him in, even though you're not going to see that on screen? Like, I didn't buy that from the characters.
No, but that part, getting locked into the asylum, that would have showed in the episode.
No, but I'm saying the way the episode is shot, the way this show is edited and the way it's all fake, they would have, I don't believe the door would have been actually locked. I would have been, they would have, like, shot footage of the caretaker relocking the doors and then put on a voiceover saying, after you locked those doors, we were in there for the whole night. Like, I don't believe they would have, and since them actually being locked in is not important to the story, I believe it isn't what the character would do, and it adds nothing to the plot.
Well, so what you're saying is it doesn't matter if they were locked in or not.
You could have just
done without that tiny little element in the story.
I would have, because it made me believe the characters less. That's all I'm going to say about that, and since it had nothing to do with the plot, well, why was it there?
It was there for the television program, not for the movie.
Yes, but I'm saying that because everything else in the television program is faked, it would have been more, you know, it would have been more keeping in line with the show if he had only said they were locked in and they hadn't actually been locked in.
No,
which,
they would
by
have
the way,
filmed the guy locking them in.
But they didn't film the guy locking them in. They just filmed the guy leaving the door, leaving, and then you heard some sounds, is my point. Like, you don't know that they're locked in. Like, all you have to take is, oh, those sounds, that was the door being locked.
Why are we arguing about this?
I'm just saying you're wrong. That's why we're arguing. And you're refusing to give it to me. That's why the argument has continued.
Wow, I'm just saying that it's, as you said, not important to the plot at all. So I really don't know why you spent so much
time. I'm just saying it's a minor thing that flies in the face of how, like, the point they're making about every single element of the show is fake. Oh, except we really got locked in. Well, why'd you really get locked in? To add one more minute of supposed scares. But anyway.
My problem is, it comes towards the end of the movie. Grave Encounters is too long. It's about 20 minutes too long, the film. There's this extended sequence with Lance, he's the show's headliner.
Yeah.
Our host. Alone in the basement, going crazy. And I really, we could have cut that down to like, couple of minutes.
I know. And then he wanders. Finally, he finds out what's going on by wandering into the end of the movie wreck. Tell me I'm wrong, America. Tell me I'm wrong.
Hi, see, for that wasn't wreck for me. That was more like maybe Skeleton Crew.
Okay, maybe, but I guess just when I saw, you know, the night vision camera, the first person night vision camera, and the pentagram on the floor, I'm like, oh, okay, so we've stumbled into the movie wreck now.
No, he stumbled. He walks into the past is what happens.
Well, the past or ghosts, or you see what I'm saying? Like, but no, it might not be the past. It might just be ghosts, and this is where they live. It's not entirely clear, because that guy was clearly like...
You know what's coming.
Oh, yeah, I know. You absolutely know.
But because the film lacks that other bookend...
Yeah, that's not really satisfying.
No, you don't get a sense of... I mean, it ends in this closure, but you don't get a good sense of the aftermath of people arriving to find everybody dead and collecting the cameras.
Or even, did they find them dead, or were the corpses never found, or like, how did this guy end up trying to release this as a for-profit endeavor?
Yeah.
All right, okay. I think that's enough about Grave Encounters. People...
No problems, but definitely worth seeing.
Yeah, it's got its problems, but I would totally recommend this movie. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I guess I just did.
Let's talk about our last movie of the evening. It is also rife with problems, but we don't recommend anybody watch.
Oh my god. Can I give your synopsis so I can tell you my one word synopsis?
Okay. All right.
Which you already know, but our viewer doesn't.
Our final movie of the evening is episode 50. An ailing mafia boss suffering from a philosophical/moral dilemma asks the crew of Paranormal Investigations, a reality ghost show, to spend a weekend in a haunted asylum to either prove or disprove the existence of ghosts. The investigators are keen to be allowed inside the building, but their giddiness turns to irritation when they learn that another rival crew will be joining them. It's skeptics versus believers in a race to the truth.
Or as I call it, episode 50. Confirmation bias, the movie.
This film. Oh my god.
You might be looking for the word infuriating.
I've never in my life come across such badly written dialogue. And it's not that like it's stilted and sounds completely unnatural. It's that these people argue in circles.
Talk in circles, and it's not clear what side of any issue they're on.
No. And they'll even say something that sounds like they've proven a point.
Yeah.
But they're actually arguing against it.
Yes. Well, okay, and I'm going to explain one thing about the movie that is all of its problems in one explanation. Okay, so there's the guys who want to disprove the supernatural and just say it's paranormal, these are effects that happen for any number of reasons, residue of dead bodies, blah 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 blah, right? So one of them, they're both in a haunted asylum, and one group, and they both want to definitively prove something. But here's the problem. One group wants to find a spirit and ask its name and prove that it was never a dead body at the asylum, thus proving that ghosts, as we know them, aren't the product of dead people, so there's no afterlife, it's just a weird thing that happens, right? And so they figure if they find someone who was never a living person, that will be proof positive that their theory that ghosts are just electrical disturbances and not dead people, you know, was 100% confirmed. But at the same time, the religious guy wants to find someone who wasn't at the asylum either, because he feels that will prove that demons, completely non-human supernatural entities, are real. So they're both looking for the exact same thing and wholeheartedly believe that if they find that thing, they will 100% prove their completely opposite beliefs. And no one in the film points this out or finds any weird contradiction there, because I don't think the writers noticed.
Well, I was so confused about what exactly people were looking for and trying to prove. Okay, so there's Paranormal Investigation.
Yeah.
The reality ghost hunting show. And their thing is they actually go around debunking haunting.
Which, by the way, there is no way that show would make it to episode 50.
The other crew, their acronym is ASSC, A-S-S-C. I don't remember what it stands for. They're a small group of Bible thumpers who completely believe in ghosts, in the afterlife, and the supernatural, and the paranormal, and what have you.
Yeah.
Okay, so these are the two people who are spending the weekend at the asylum. Also, I might mention that the lead men for each group hate each other.
Yeah.
But it's not really important why. It's to create conflict.
I know, just so they can constantly be bickering.
So, you've got that. And now you have the film outlines. There are four levels of hauntings, I guess, or ghosts. Like Close Encounters. There are four yeah. kinds of Close Encounters. There are
residue.
There's residue,
a thing that happened that you can still see. Intelligent, a ghost you can talk to. Poltergeist, ghosts that throw stuff around and, you know.
Right, which are trickster entities.
Trickster entities.
Are tricksters.
Yeah, they're trickster entities and demons.
And then you have demons which weren't human.
Yeah, whereas trickster entities were human.
Right.
Yeah, they were.
I already have a problem there because I don't think poltergeists are tricksters.
No, not really. Like, they were misusing those terms.
That's my issue and my unwilling suspension of disbelief on that topic.
Okay.
And so the PI guys, it's unclear whether or not they actually believe in ghosts. I think that they do.
Yeah.
But they're actually looking for what is essentially a demon. And then the ASSC people believe in everything, and they think they're dealing with a poltergeist.
Yeah.
Because they've got a medium. But the problem is, if they think that they're dealing with a poltergeist, then they have no reason to suspect that what this ghost is telling them is true, because we firmly established that poltergeists lie. And yet.
I know. They really do take a lot of that stuff on faith. Internal coherence is not this film's strong suit.
Oh my goodness. So then again, you get these sort of arguments that go in circles where people are arguing the same thing over and over again. But it makes absolutely no sense.
Well, and the weird part is, there's a sequence in this film where I don't know why these characters are pushing it. Like, okay, you know, you've been here 5 minutes, you've been here 2 hours, you've conclusively proven the existence of ghosts that were once human, you know, and are now just entities. You can go now, you know?
Yeah.
But they keep searching, and I'm like, yeah, but you could, but I have to find the paperwork or something. Yeah, but you can come back during the day and look for that. You don't have to stay in the spooky hospital full of things that want to hurt you.
Well, the film just goes completely off the rails. So they prove the existence of ghosts, or disprove it, depending on which side you're on, because, as you said, they use the same evidence to come to two different conclusions. Which is mind-boggling.
I know.
And then the film takes a really strange turn.
Yeah, and this film previously had problems with being a fake documentary. Like, it's established that this is all supposed to be their footage, but it goes third person, and where is the person holding the camera? Like, a lot.
Well, it does that all the time. That's not, I was going to get to that. That's not what I was talking about just now. Sorry. The movie takes this weird turn in its story.
Yeah.
Where it turns out this isn't a ghost. It's a demon. Straight from hell.
Yep.
And who isn't actually on the premises.
No.
The demon was summoned by a patient in the hospital.
Yes.
While he was incarcerated up the road at the maximum security prison.
Yes. And the trickster who they've been dealing with summoned the demon?
No, there is no trickster.
Wait, I thought there was both a trickster and a demon.
No, I think it's just the demon.
It's really hard to tell.
No, wait. There.
Should not be this hard.
The guy who summoned the demon.
Yeah, we see the ghost of the guy who summoned the demon. I swear to God, we see him, right?
Yeah, he's there. You know what? It doesn't fucking matter.
No, it doesn't.
The point is, this movie doesn't know what the hell it's doing, either in terms of its story or how it's even telling the story. Because as you said, this is supposed to be a found footage movie or a fake documentary. I'm even unclear because it's such a mess. But the movie switches constantly between first and third person.
Well, to the point where, and it doesn't even wait until the action gets started. Right at the beginning of the movie, they're going to meet with the guy who is either a mob boss or he might be like just the heir of a bunch of rich people, and he's lived the life of a rich scumbag. It's not really clear. But anyway, so they're going to meet him. And before they get in there to meet him, there's footage of him talking to his lawyer about exactly how much they should tell these people.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why are we seeing footage from before the camera crew arrived?
Yeah. And the movie does this all
constantly.
Constantly. It doesn't introduce the cameramen for either crew, but we see them.
Yeah. And sometimes they're clearly not there.
And yeah, and other times, the film has been, I'm going to go with fake documentary because the film is actually edited. There are interviews interspersed throughout the film.
Which, by the way, there's a great thing where the interviews interspersed throughout the film. Excuse me. But they're always, like, one person is always interviewed at one location, but they're talking about stuff that they experience like before, like, so an interview with someone at the beginning, it's like they did a talking head then, but then later in the movie, they'll be talking about something that happened in between the two talking heads. So I'm like, wait, you went with the same lighting and went back to the same room and re-recorded this talking head. And now suddenly your costume is exactly the same as it was earlier.
It's like they just went back and it's like they did a reshoot.
But what clearly happened was, like, the filmmakers shot all of the talking heads in a block.
Yeah.
Without considering that there would be costume changes and location changes and things like that. And that really hurt the movie. Right, it makes it feel like they went back and did a reshoot, even though some of those characters did not survive.
Well, no, not like, not the larger apparatus of episodes did a reshoot, but like the fake documentary did a reshoot.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It feels like the fake documentary shot all the talking heads after it was over, but that doesn't really make sense. Also not making sense, I'm just going to say it, the CGI devil.
He's just standing there, hanging out.
Have you just been waiting in this hole?
It's that easy to dispatch a devil? Who knew?
Yeah, like, all you gotta do is show him the cross.
And he gets sucked back into hell.
And the best part is, you don't really necessarily have to have a lot of faith, because just seeing a devil gives you all the belief in demons you need to banish one, apparently.
I suppose it could bring up an interesting ideas about the nature of faith. Who has to have, I mean, who has to have the faith here? The demon or the person doing the banishing? The demon obviously has a lot of faith because
he's a demon.
Takes a look at that cross and he hightails it out of there.
Oh my god. Oh yeah, this movie really falls apart in the last half hour. Like, it's just.
It falls apart within the first 10 minutes.
Yeah, no, but you gotta admit, it's a mess for most of the movie, but then everything after the medium gets killed is just, what the hell am I watching? Oh my god. And then it's like, oh yeah, there was a serial killer as part of a satanic cult, and the warden of his prison was also in the cult. What? Where did that come from?
Again, I think these people just, they had access to some cool looking location.
I know, and they just went nuts with it. By the way, least abandoned asylum ever. All new fixtures, completely clean. There is not a speck of dust anywhere. The office they go to has flowers in it. Maybe those are plastic flowers, but still.
Yeah.
Like,
I also took great offense at the psychology students that appear in the movie. Because they do, like, there's a series of interviews, not only with, like, the cast, like, the crew, but experts in the field of, like, psychology and psychiatry and computer science for some reason. I really wasn't clear on that one. But, so they have these two girls who are supposed to be psychology students. I'm not a psychology student. I never was. But just what I'm objecting to is the stereotype of the female student in general. So basically, they've got these two really prissy girls in glasses acting all academic.
I know.
And it's like, oh, come on. Have you never met a grad student?
No, they really haven't.
I guess not.
Yeah, the severe and scolding school marmish.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
I think we know better than they do. We have glasses, after all.
I mean, I have glasses. Yeah, they got that part right. But, you know, dressed like a slob half the time.
Oh, I know. Oh, this movie. But yeah, but I gotta say, it's true. The premise breaks down 1 second in. When you realize we're asked to believe that there is such a thing as a popular show about debunking hauntings. Oh, God. You know, at least friggin' Penn and Teller only did one episode about that. The idea that people would watch 49 episodes about, no, you're just seeing lights.
Yeah. You were just huffing paint.
Oh. Oh, God, this friggin' movie. All right, so I think that's it for episode 50. We might have buried that one.
Yes.
So let's move forward to our narcissism watch.
Well, as I said, I have got a long post about Grave Encounters up on Zombies, and I'm working on one about episode 50, but it's slow going.
It's a rough one to write about.
Quite a lot to muddle through. So check out zombas.net for all your ghost hunting, found footage, fake documentary needs.
Well, the point I think you should point out is it's a complete misrepresentation of the scientific method, because at no point is it ever clear what would prove or disprove their theories. And if you don't have terms for whether the experiment is a success or a failure, you're not scientists. All right, now that I'm done criticizing the movie, for real this time, swing by vartagelon.com to find all of your Criminal Minds reviews needs, as well as panels from hilarious comic books from the 50s and Tales from the Crypt.
All right, check out the Avon's blog, the avon.blogspot.com, send us an email, the avon@gmail.com. vote in our poll. I have poll results.
Ooh, what are they?
From last week. Last week's question was, are you enjoying American Horror Story? Because we clearly weren't. There's a tie between no, I'm not enjoying it, and I don't know if I like it or not. In second place were the people who were enjoying the show.
Well, nice, there's some of them.
But our the majority of listeners have no idea what that is. They don't even know about it.
Oh, poor American Horror Story.
I know.
See, their mistake was not having constant nudity, Nip Tuck style. That way people would know about it.
Right.
Although I don't know if you can do that on FX. I have no idea. Or wait, was Nip Tuck on FX?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I never watched Nip Tuck.
I didn't like it.
Okay. So, I guess that's going to wrap us up for this week. Until next time, I'm Count Vargelon.
I'm DM.
Have yourselves a great evening, and thanks for watching.
Good night.